I love cooking when I have time. That's the biggest thing. I also hate cleaning up after cooking.
Oh my God, I hate cleaning the kitchen.
I hate it so much. And that's the worst thing about cooking. That's what they don't tell you about
it. You make a mess when you cook, even if you're trying to be tidy. Concise. It's just like...
How did I end up with 11 pots, 2 pans?
For me, it's spoons and knives, or spoons and forks.
Spoons,
yeah.
Specifically.
I'm like, this is my spoon. But then I'll put it in the sink, and I'm like, I'm done with it, and then I need a spoon. So I've started to train myself to be like, you are my buddy, you are my spoon for this for this prep.
You are my emotional
spoon. You may not leave me.
You are my emotional
spoon. You know what I love about cooking? Aprons.
No. Okay, yes, aprons. But also back to the spoons.
For Yeah.
So I have a spoon dish.
Yeah, like a little spoon rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get that.
I have that too. I do, but I was out of habit for so long for some reason. I'd be like, oh, I used it. Done. See ya. And then I got 5 spoons in the sink and I'm like, oh, Pete's sake.
How am I gonna eat now? How am I gonna eat the soup with those spoons?
I'm thinking to myself, did you really need to do all that?
Yeah.
No, you didn't. On our food episode,
yes.
I am going to be sharing with you an article titled Vincent's Fricassee. The author of this article is Douglas Wissing, and this was published in the Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History, Spring 2009, Volume 21, Number 2 issue. Doug, Mr. Wissing.
Thank you for being on the show again.
Yeah, you've made your second appearance. He starts this article by describing a typical fricassee Sunday morning scene in Vincent's. And I'm just going to share that with you.
Does he explain what a fricassee is?
We'll get there.
Okay.
Hold your horses. We'll get there. Mr. Wissing says, it was the typical fricassee Sunday morning in Vincennes, the old French town on the banks of the Wabash River in Highland Park's tin-roofed pavilion. Intent men in red aprons tended 10 enormous kettles, each holding 50 to 60 gallons of roiling brown soup. As the gas burners hissed and flared, the cooks kept careful watch over their precious fare. The metal stirrers endlessly whirled, keeping the thick stew from scorching. Though only 9 a.m. on a white-hot southern Indiana summer day, a line of people already snaked toward the kitchen. An ancient swamp cooler fan blew chilly gales in on one side of the open shelter, only to be reduced to a tepid breeze by the other. In the welcoming shade of the canopy, servers ladled rich porridge into bowls, pots, and jars in a steady clip, scarcely pausing to exchange the obligatory pleasantries. Everyone had fricassee on their minds.
So it sounds like it's a soup.
A soup. Stew, I would say. This article is what he's just kind of foreshadowing. Follows one church in Vincennes and their fricassee creation. The question, the million-dollar question, what is fricassee? It is a stew. He describes Vincent's fricassee is different than maybe a more traditional French fricassee, which would have chicken or duck. But Vincent's fricassee is, quote, a sultry dish. It is velvety with beef and chicken that's cooked overnight. It's smoky with the bacon, and he said it's perked with black pepper. Worcestershire sauce and the tang of lemon is also present. Remnant bits of onions and carrots, corn, peas, and potatoes float in the unctuous stew. This man can paint a picture.
My mouth is watering.
I think we need to take another road trip.
I know.
This story started out just as like any other article that I was reading and learning about, but it quickly became kind of reminded me of my family. My family is from Vincennes.
Oh.
And some of our history is incorporated in this article, which was really fun, and I'll get into that in a second. I think what's important to understand about fricassee is that it is kind of unique to this area. The author mentions the stew being cousins to the Burgoo stew, which is originally from Kentucky. It's also sort of related to the Brunswick stew, which is sort of a southern U.S. delicacy. And then it has sort of ties to some chowders of southern Illinois. So it's kind of this unique
thing.
Yes. That is kind of like a lot of things, but is unique in a lot of ways.
What is the difference between a stew and a soup?
Stew to me is thicker. It's got heartier bits to it.
Sure. Okay.
That's personal, though. I think soups are more brothy, you know?
But then what about, like, tomato soup that's kind of thicker? Or broccoli cheddar soup, which is also kind of thicker. Those stews?
Yeah, I don't know. But exact difference is. So fricassee is culinarily linked to the Creole trading post days of Vincennes. So the Vincennes history really starts in 1720 when it was one of the French Empire's most remote American outposts. And the author says the end of the line for many generations of travelers who found themselves traveling from Quebec to Vincennes as part of the fur trade. So it's Creole in origin, but we have a lot of like French influence and Canadian people in Quebec come down too. Mm-hmm. The French heritage in this place and in Vincennes lives on in many ways. From family histories, there's an old French cemetery in Vincennes. There's, the author mentions, crazy French land grant survey lines. So the construction of this city is kind of French-based. You have the George Rogers Clark Memorial. And then, of course, fricassee is another defining piece of this French culture.
Sure.
In Vincennes. In French colonial days, fricassee was a sort of Creole stone soup, and it was composed of lots of vegetables and random meat, whatever was available at the time. And the author mentioned squirrel was often that meat of choice. But I think mostly the author equates fricassee with Vincennes Catholic parishes, more of a church-centered article. At least he makes it fricassee seem to be church-centric in some ways.
Sure.
He says that Vincennes Catholic parishes have long used fricassee for church fundraisers. Specifically, he mentions the St. Francis Xavier Parish, which exists right next to the George Rogers Clark Memorial in Vincennes. Hmm. This is my family connection. My dad and uncle were baptized there. My grandma and grandpa were married there. My great-grandma, who just died, had her funeral there.
Oh,
this
wow.
Church is very close to my family in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's funny, though, the article does go on to say that though many in the community think this church's fricassee is watery and bland. I've never had fricassee. I've never heard of it. I need to text my dad and ask him.
They're coming for you.
My family's from Vincennes, and so I'm like, is this something my dad knows about? I need to do some inquiring. This parish was traditionally the church for the French people who lived in Vincennes. The St. John's Parish, however, is a mid-19th century German immigrants church that, according to this article, has some of the most acclaimed fricassee in Vincennes. St. John's is who's cooking the fricassee in the opening of this article to kind of give you some context.
Sure.
So now we dive into how St. John's makes their fricassee. Their chef, his name is, or was, he passed away, unfortunately, at the end of this article. We talk about that. Okay, anyway. So without further ado, the story of St. John's fricassee is that Aloise Yoakum, he is the 40-year fricassee master at St. John. I'm full of masters. Fricassee master, quilt master.
What a title.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, the article mentions that he will not share his recipe with anyone. And Wissing interviews some of his parish members as well, Aloise's parish members, to like just get to know about him and their culture. And one interviewer says that he won't share, that Aloise will not share this recipe with anyone. And they're worried because he's had 3 open heart surgeries. And each time they're like freaking out because they don't think the recipe is anywhere. And the thought of losing this recipe is just unimaginable.
Sorry,
right?
Aloise.
Yes.
Care about this recipe.
Right. But at the time that this article was written, St. John served fricassee on the 4th Sunday of June every year and on the 1st Sunday of October in the Vincennes Highland Park. This was a tradition they had. It was a fundraiser, I think, for the church. And he, Aloise, was the star of the fricassee show. So the fricassee making starts the day before it's served. So 24 hours before it's time to prepare or to serve the fricassee is when they start. And the preparations happen in a really long sort of park gazebo. This gazebo has dozens of volunteers. Like, I think that the article mentioned 10 pots of fricassee end up being made. So you've got pots and people and all kinds of stuff. Dozens of volunteers prep about 148 fresh chickens for this dish. There's 170 pounds of beef and 60 pounds of bacon that go into this. And this is just the meat part. And all of these meats go into separate pots for long boils to cook them. Once night hits, the meat has finished cooking and they can take the meat out. And for the chickens, at least, they have to debone the chickens. Get in there on these hot chickens and do what they have to do. Wissing describes this as a really social event. Like, volunteers are joshing each other. They're talking about like high school sports and weddings and politics. And, you know, it's this cultural and community-based thing. And as they are working on the chickens, they start to grind the meat. They're grinding the meat and it is stored in these big galvanized tubs, basically. And what I'm trying to get at is the quantity of this is almost unimaginable. Some volunteers work with the meat and grinding it, and others are mixing chicken and beef stock together with the addition of pork lard. And Alois says it's really important not to overdo the lard because you don't want the fricassee to be too fatty. As the meat is getting ground, the vegetables are also being ground. And this includes 300 pounds of onions, which are peeled and quartered. Wissing describes one volunteer approaching him with tears in her eyes. Her face is red. She's been peeling and cutting onion upon onion, just like never ending.
Yeah.
And she's like, this hurts. Literally, article, she says it hurts. And he's like, yeah, sure it does. 300 pounds of onions.
Thanks, ma'am.
I'm like, she needed some goggles, I think. You know, have you seen those?
Some gloves. Goggles, gloves.
Hazmat suit.
Yeah. Or it should be a rotation.
Yeah. Like, would you rather be would you rather be manning the vats of boiling meat or onions? Mind you, it's a hot day in June.
Onions.
Me too.
I don't want to. I'd be sweating.
Me too.
I'd be sweating
too much. I would just come prepared, I think.
Yeah. I think I would bring my own goggles, bring gloves. You know.
And just tough it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Swim goggles, mind you.
The nose covering. So you're breathing through the mouth, maybe.
I don't even mind about the nose. It's definitely the eyes.
Oh, really? My nose runs.
But, like, also, it's just quartering, which I feel like I have a pretty good onion quartering, peeling.
Your talent, like, you've done it enough.
Technique, yeah.
Yeah, and I think you'd find a groove in this
I'm
story.
I'm good with repetitive tasks.
The recipe also includes 600 pounds of potatoes, many bundles of celery, and Wissing says eight. Forest of parsley. And as all of this is happening, they're also uncanning gallon cans of carrots and peas and creamed corn are all going in at the same time. And also there's a cleanup crew that goes around and they take hoses and they clean up the floor because there's a lot going on, lots of meat and lots of veggies going on. And so they are cleaning up. The scene is the night has fallen. There's water on the floor, the smells of cooking meat and onions. And I'm just trying to paint a picture here. Alois and his family look after the final product. When everything is added sort of to the pan, he sort of takes charge at this point and he starts seasoning. He adds salt and pepper and lemons, tomato juice, and 2 gallons of Worcestershire sauce go into this recipe.
That's a lot of Worcestershire.
It sure is. As the night continues, beers are opened and, you know, it's a social event. Mm-hmm. The next morning, people are starting to line up incredibly early. I think it starts at maybe 9, 8:30, but people are in line before that. And then once church gets out, it gets even crazier. People bring jars and pots. They bring pans that have clamping around the side because, God forbid, you waste a drop.
Lose it, yeah.
Some bring Tupperware, and they get filled. People will take back, like, massive quantities or big quantities of fricassee. Some people just come for just a bowl. That's all they really need. But sooner rather than later, word is spreading that 8 of the 10 pots are empty, and everything is done by 11:10. Everything is empty by then.
That's wild.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that kind of reminds me of? Strawberry Festival?
Oh, yeah.
In downtown?
Well, there's one in Franklin, too, and it's crazy as well. I mean, people go crazy over this kind of thing. And
I love it, though.
I do, too.
I think we need more of them.
I do, too. I want to go to St. John's. I want to have some fricassee.
Yeah.
All the pots of fricassee are empty by 11:10, and Alois is really proud, and he's happy, and he's like, that's the earliest it's ever emptied. Unfortunately, Alois did die on March 15th, 2005. This article was written in 2009, so I don't know when Wissing did the reporting and the info on this.
It must have been while he was still alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so Alois dies in 2005. Like I said before, some people are worried about the recipe. But not to worry, he gave the recipe to the father at the church so that somebody has the recipe. Alois's son and nephew took over the fricassee making operation, and they have the recipe, and everybody reports that their fricassee is just as good as Alois's, though the legend of Alois lives on in the fricassee, and there you have it, Vincent's fricassee. Yeah, so the real point of that article was just to explore what this community event looks like and how fricassee exists in the Vincent's community now.
Yeah, that is really cool. I think a lot of different places have a dish that is really important to them, like historically.
Yeah.
I go to Pierogi Fest in Whiting, which is an entire festival over several days dedicated to pierogies.
Wow. And to think, that's several days of pierogies. Okay. They work this hard and cook this much food
for
a couple hours.
Yeah. Well, you served up our main course.
Served up. That's a good one.
I am going to be providing dessert. Donuts.
Oh, yum.
My story is from one of our blogs from June 1st, 2021. It is called Producing Desire, The Heritage of Donut Shops, and it is by Dr. Paul R. Mullins.
Producing Desire.
I know. Isn't that good? That's a good title.
Quite sultry, yeah.
Dr. Mullen starts off this blog by talking about Long's Bakery, which is a famous bakery here in Indianapolis, and it is on West 16th Street, and it's been there since 1955, and it opened just 2 years after the last streetcar was retired in Indianapolis.
If you are from Indy, you know and you love Long's. It is like an institution.
It is one of the first places when I moved here. It was one of the first places that anyone took me. They were like, you need to try Long's Donuts.
It's an institution. Did you go to the one on 16th or did you go to Southport?
The one on 16th.
Yeah, I grew up going to the one on Southport.
That makes sense.
That's closer to where I grew up. And they're very good, but I've also heard that the one on 16th just has a je ne sais quoi about it that is just undeniable.
It is very classic. It feels very classic donut shop. It brings, and we'll get into it later because Mullins literally wrote the book on donuts, as I later found out. He talks about the importance of these places. So every morning you can find a very diverse mix of people lined up at Long's Donuts.
You can.
Their donuts. And when they opened, 16th Street was like very much a artery into the city.
Okay.
So commuters would stop at Long's on their way into work, and that became, you know, this pattern. And over the years, donuts have obviously faced critique due to like unhealthiness and things like that. And like, they have been stereotyped as places for like almost dive bars for like working people and cops.
Interesting.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Long's, as you have mentioned, has been celebrated by basically everyone in the city, and it's been there since the early 20th century.
It's funny that you mention all kinds of people in line, because you're right. I was there not too long ago, and you'll often find people in their pajamas, but you'll find people in business suits. You'll find people who just gone to work out. You'll find all kinds of people.
I remember we were getting ready for the state contest for National History Day, and we went before the contest, and it was full. And I was like, it is. Like,
it's always full.
It was like 5 in the morning.
Yes, always full.
On a Saturday.
Yes, and it's charming because they only take cash.
Yeah.
It's just, I love Long's. I have so many, you know, food and memories are connected.
Modest shops like Long's and national chains became these like social spaces in Indiana communities, right? Like, you were just very fired up about Long's Donuts.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I think back to, we have a donut shop where I'm from called Munster Donuts, and it reminds me of Long's, and that is a family owned institution. They're open 20. They used to be open 24 hours. I'm not sure if they still are, but shout out to Munster Donuts if you're ever up in the
How region. Does a Long's donut compare to a Munster donut?
I feel like I will get heckled if I chat. They're comparable. They're homemade cake donuts, right?
Oh, cake. Long's are like known for their yeast.
Are they?
Mm-hmm. Is that what you had there?
No, I had a cake donut.
Their classic yeast is the best.
I'm such a fan of maple
frosting. Their maple cake.
So their cake.
Their cake donuts are so good. Their blueberry cake are amazing. Chocolate cake are amazing. Yeah. I need to go to Long's now.
Anyway, so these donut shops are like these hearts of community. And contemporary donuts, though, have become very like standardized foods, right? Think like your Dunkin's.
Yes,
and, like,
yes.
And these foods, donuts, are actually very old. Fried flour really get their start in the Neolithic era.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so they're old. Mullen says that nearly every global cuisine has savory or sweet fried pastries. Washington Irving was one of the first people to use the word donut in 1809 in the history of New York to describe enormous balls of sweetened dough fried in hog's fat and called them donuts, or oliekoek, which is a Dutch word. Now, in Indianapolis, there are not a ton of Dutch people.
Yeah.
But that would have been known in genuine Dutch families and communities.
Sure.
The description that he uses suggests that Dutch pastries were then absorbed into American cuisine in the 19th century. And you see donuts appear in English cookbooks, 1803 edition, which also included an appendix of American recipes. Mm. So you see it pop up more and more in the early 19th century.
Okay.
And these donuts have become staples of American life. In 1917, the Salvation Army popularized donuts when 11 young women were sent to American troops in Europe to provide support.
Those donut van things, right?
Yeah, and they would provide donuts to remind the troops of home. And that's something that Salvation Army still does today.
It's funny, you mentioned the nostalgia and like how armed forces used donuts to create this sense of home. But that ultimately, though, donuts in some shape or form are a part of every culture.
Yeah, just fried dough. Like,
yeah, fried dough, yeah.
Yeah, like I think of, there's a Greek fest where I'm from and they do loukoumades.
What's that?
It's a fried dough that's drizzled with like honey, cinnamon, and I think it's walnuts.
Oh, yum.
They're so
That sounds good. Delicious.
So good. When they're fresh.
Yes.
Ugh, so good.
I have always just ate a donut room temperature. So when you say fresh, some people will live and die by a hot donut. Have you ever?
Have I ever experienced
Have a you ever had donut? A hot donut?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have never.
They're good.
So I think I need to start microwaving or heating up my donuts.
Well, because people are real serious about donuts. So
literally.
I think that after donut shops, the next place my head goes for donuts is apple orchards.
Interesting.
Because think about how often in the fall, people flock to apple orchards
for
to
apple get flavored.
Apple cinnamon donuts or pumpkin spice donuts. But in the 1920s, back to the story here, donuts become common and are mass produced. And a man named Adolph Levitt developed a donut machine prototype, and he put the machine in his bakery window and marketed it as a chain of donuts known as Mayflower donuts. But he created this almost theater of donut making.
Oh, right? Like how Krispy Kreme used to do it?
Yeah. And the Mayflower Donuts eventually opened a North Capitol Street bakery and in 1942. And in 1927, Downy Flake Donut Shop opened on North Pennsylvania Street. So you have these places that are just like popping up. And they figured out that people liked watching donuts get made. And they said, Downy Flake specifically said, it performs the entire donut making task within itself. It cuts the donut, floats it to the top of the fat, which is heated electronically and kept at just the right temperature. Fries the donuts on one side, turns it over, fries the other side, and then ejects it from the machine without the touch of human hands. It would be a cool thing to see if you'd never seen a donut be made before.
Yeah, or never seen that kind of like automation like that firsthand.
They figured out that watching the donuts be made boosted like anticipation,
yeah,
heightened the desire of the treat because you're like watching it happen in front of you. Due to this phenomenon in Indianapolis, scores of family-owned bakeries opened in the 1950s. And Mullins offers up in 1956 alone, Brackney's Donuts on East 21st Street, the Judy Donut Shop on Rockville Road, the Knotty Pine Donuts on West Washington offer donuts alongside chains like Downy Dunker on East Market in North Pennsylvania, Downy Flake on West Market, Krispy Kreme, and the many Rosalind Bakeries.
Mm-hmm.
So crazy.
Yeah.
And that's 1 year.
Wow. I've never thought of donuts as like a trend before. I've just thought...
Well, because we've always had them around.
Yeah, in my lifetime. But to think of them as this fad...
That like...
Is so funny.
Well, a fad that never left, right?
Well, I mean, a fad that changed, but its essence never left. Yeah.
And that is something Mullins goes on to talk about. So now in the 21st century, we have now turned to gourmet donuts.
Yes.
And gourmet donuts defy like this mass-produced donut and have started to characterize the American donuts for the century. And instead of appealing to like the old, they're appealing to this imagination that desires superior flavor, embraces culinary creativity, and the fancies that they have are discerning an educated palate.
Mm-hmm.
Gourmet donut shops often are run by professional chefs and use organic and artisanal flavors to make like idiosyncratic flavors, kind of like Jack's Donuts does their super fancy donuts.
Well, I think like they are like putting twists on donuts. Like they have like a fried donut croissant thing.
Sure, cronuts.
Is that what it's called?
That's a big thing.
Yeah, that's like a twist on a donut.
Mullins ascertains that although cosmopolitan foodies have flocked to these gourmet donut shops, the masses have remained steadfastly committed to local donut shops, favored chains, and traditional glazed and caked donuts.
Mm-hmm.
And because food is such a powerful social mechanism, you see donuts bonding little leagues, church groups, families. For the Indy 500, people will line up at Long's and consume boxes and boxes of donuts.
That little white box is so infamous if you're from around here. They come in this white box.
Yes.
I just live, laugh, love. Wait, what? What?
I was saying, well, that's what Munster donuts come into. Oh. They come in a little white box.
Yeah, well, I guess...
That's why it makes me feel... That's why Long's makes me
Gives you some nostalgia.
For home, yeah.
Yeah, that's sweet that it could do that for you. Mm-hmm. Donuts are just amazing tools of emotional and culinary magic.
I know. Well, and that's why I was going to ask you, I was like, where's your favorite donut shop? But now I
Long's.
Feel like, yeah.
Exclamation point, underline. Yeah.
I'm wondering for our listeners, if you're listening on a platform that allows you to make comments, leave us a comment on what your favorite home donut shop is.
Yeah.
Like, where is that place where you live?
Yeah.
I'm interested to know, because, like, for me, that's Munster Donuts in Munster, Indiana. For Reagan, that's Long's here in Indianapolis.
But I have friends in Columbus. There's a donut shop in Columbus that they rave about, too. It's like every community is, you're right.
They have a donut shop.
I never thought of a donut shop being such a cultural community center.
It's definitely a uniting force. If you would like to learn more about the history of donuts, Dr. Mullins published a book called Glazed America, A History of the Donut.
That's a cute title.
Isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's more to learn.
Donuts. I just think donuts are a really, really happy food, too.
Yeah.
What's your favorite kind of donut? You like cake, but do you have a favorite flavor of cake?
Maple.
That's your favorite?
I love the maple frosted
cake
donut.
I love those, too. I love a jelly-filled.
That is my second favorite.
Which I know is sometimes polarizing because people are like, ew. I love a jelly-filled or I have a top three I can't pick.
Okay.
Jelly-filled or a blueberry cake or a chocolate cake.
I'm not a chocolate person.
I love it.
Which I know is also a polarizing opinion.
I know quite a few people who are not chocolate people. So to me, that's not that crazy.
Yeah. I like lighter sweet flavors. So sure. Like caramel, maple.
Okay.
And fruit.
Yes.
Kind of lighter.
Yeah, sweet. I agree. Donuts just make me smile.
Now I'm hungry.
It's time for lunch.
It is time for lunch. Listeners, thank you so much for joining us on this food journey. We're excited to see you next time.
Yes.
As we talk about more exciting and fun topics.
Go grab a donut.
Go grab a donut.
I think I'm going to get one after work. Just sounds like I have to after today. On that note, thank you for listening and have a fabulous donut-filled day.
Bye.
Bye.